From Jerusalem, Israel, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Gary Marcuse is a journalist and documentary filmmaker who focuses on the history of environmental movements across the world, from the United States and Canada to Russia and China.
There's now between 50 and 100,000 demonstrations every year in China about environmental issues. It is, in fact, one of the areas where Chinese citizens can speak out.
But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss the testing of intercontinental ballistic missiles in North Korea and the ongoing security situation between the Israelis and Palestinians. That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, you're in your home state of Alaska this week, and so let's talk about North Korea. Last week, North Korea tested another missile. They've been doing this kind of off and on for a while, and there's a lot of chatter in Washington, D.C. about what's going on in North Korea, given the nuclear situation and now, of course, the ongoing missile situation. So from your front porch in Alaska, tell us what you're seeing.
Well, I'm not seeing much literally from my front porch, but this is something that I think Americans in general and Alaskans specifically are a little bit more concerned about than they've had been for other tests, because it looks like from the range of this tested missile that it could potentially reach the state of Alaska. And so that is obviously a concern. As you said, this isn't the first launch. We've seen 17 this year already, so quite a few. And it was strategically done on the 4th of July. We responded the next day with some war games that we undertook with South Korea. But what's been interesting here is what's going to come of this. I mean, if it could hit Alaska, there are some that are saying that the next launches, you know, that they could get even further down to the lower 48. So some interesting stuff there. The other big thing in the news was the G20 meeting in Germany this past week as well. And that was an opportunity for President Trump to talk with the leader of China. And of course, China is kind of seen as the linchpin in all of this. They are really the only ones that have much sway in what North Korea does. And so there's been some interesting discussions there. Both China and the United States have come out and said that they had this opportunity to talk, that there are still some issues, but they still feel that they can work together on getting North Korea to balk somewhat on this, but we'll see. Also in Alaska this week, though, in preparation, they did take a THAAD defense system. We talked about this on the show before, where South Korea also has one of these THAAD defense systems. And they sent out a missile from Hawaii, and the THAAD system in Alaska was able to shoot it down. So we are taking precautionary measures here and in the United States as a whole.
So Suzette, you're in Israel. There's been a little bit of unrest there. What are you seeing?
Well, Rebecca, I've been in Israel for a couple of weeks, and I'm in Jerusalem right now. I've been in Tel Aviv before, been in Jerusalem just for a couple of days. But, you know, my sense is that things were pretty calm and pretty kind of laid back here. Everybody was just living their life, and Israelis, the Palestinians, seem to be at a relatively peaceful time. But then, interestingly, just yesterday, actually, there was an attack at the Dome of the Rock, which is right near the Western Wall in the Old City here in Jerusalem. And there were three assailants that attacked a couple of Israeli soldiers. Unfortunately, all of them died. The Israeli soldiers were attacked and were killed, died later at the hospital. And then, of course, other police officers, Israeli soldiers, killed the three assailants. Also, interestingly, those three assailants are Arab Israelis. They're from the northern part of Israel. And so at least this is what I'm gathering so far. And to be honest, I haven't really been able to look at much of the news. I've just gathered it from being here. We heard about the attack this morning. My daughter and I were at a museum, so we weren't in the Old City, but we went to the Old City later and heard about it. And it was pretty chaotic what we saw after that. Very heavy police presence, whereas we were in the same place yesterday. We were at the Western Wall yesterday, and the police presence was hardly even noticeable. It was just very, very relaxed, as I said. And today, completely different experience. Lots of police and special forces, and very few people that could make it into the Old City. They closed it down. down the old city. After the attack this morning, only one gate was open. There were very few tourists, very few shop owners even. In fact, a lot of the shop owners are Palestinians. They run their shops there. They were unable to make it to work. There was apparently a lot of chaos over that. So quite the change of events in Israel in one day. But I think these are just things that they live with. In fact, when we got out of the taxi at the old city, he said, another day in the life in Israel. So unfortunately, these things happen here. But anyway, Rebecca, both of us will be back in the studio soon. And thanks again for calling in from Alaska. And I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for your analysis, as always.
Of course. Thank you for the conversation.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Gorlot. Next, I'll talk with journalist and filmmaker Gary Marcuse about the environmental movement in China. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Gary Marcuse is a filmmaker who is based in Vancouver, Canada. He makes documentaries about the history of environmental movements. His films have taken him around the world, from the United States and Canada to Russia and China. Gary Marcuse, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I look forward to talking about your work in China in particular. But can we first start on your overall approach to environmental activism? You're a documentary filmmaker, journalist, and you focus primarily on environmental issues. Just tell us kind of what brought you there. You're Canadian. Is that related at all?
I actually grew up in the United States. I think ever since I was a child, I've always loved being outdoors. I grew up in the Northwest, and so we spent summers by the lake and out by the Oregon coast. And the beauty of nature was instilled in me, probably by my mother. Used to say, "Let's go out for a walk along the stream and see if we can find some turtles and snails." You know, that would be the day's journey. And so being in the middle of it is something I always really, really enjoyed, and not something that every child who grows up in this big city can say, but that was my childhood. And so that kind of probably oriented me towards that. I'm now in my 60s, so I lived through a 50-year period where our understanding of nature and of the environment and of the planet has been completely transformed. Completely unlike the world that I was introduced to when I was 5 or 6 years old. We've learned about ecospheres, we've learned about environments, we've learned about the international nature of pollution. You know, we have a view that is more poetic and more tragic at the same time about the beautiful ecosystem that we live in. We understand it better, but we're also realizing that we better understand it even more and do something about it. So I guess I'm possessed in part by the feeling that the environmental issue is actually the issue of our time. And if I can make a film that shows where the environmental movement started in the United States, for example, and Canada, and show how our views have changed, then I can help to educate a younger generation about the way in which we see the world differently now than we did then. But that's the world that they're growing up in. So you kind of, you know, if you can contribute to that, it feels like I'm doing something useful.
How did you begin to examine the emergence of environmental movements in Canada and the United States as compared to other countries like Russia and China?
So when I started making films for the Nature of Things at CBC, where I began to look at the emergence of green movements, I decided, first of all, to look at how the green movement emerged in North America. I hadn't really thought that I would try and look at it in different parts of the world. But when I saw the drama and the interest and the intrigues that took place in North America and Canada, and traced the beginning of the environmental movement all the way back to the Ban the Bomb movement, it was really striking that the beginning of the environmental movement in the United States was really young women going out and demonstrating against atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons because they didn't want their children to have strontium in their bloodstreams and in their bones. And so I thought, geez, you know, that's such an interesting way of looking at the beginning of that environmental movement. I wonder what's happening in other countries. You know, how have environmental movements, could they emerge in a place like China and Russia, where obviously we need them or we're all in trouble. I went on from there to look at the emergence of a green movement in Russia. I didn't know if there was one. I was hopeful. And for a brief time, there was a kind of a flourishing of a green movement that was prompted by the cleanup of a lot of the pollution in the Arctic left behind by the collapse of the Soviet Union. They left nuclear submarines lying on the beach, you know, with nuclear reactors still in them. And the Norwegians got very upset about this because that's right next to their country. And that set off an environmental movement which has since been very severely suppressed. The NGOs are in very bad shape in Russia right now. Putin really considers them to be somehow threats.
Well, it's really fascinating. And I'm particularly interested in the environmental movement in general, because as an academic, my past academic life, I've studied social movements, but in a different issue area. And it always seemed to me, it struck me, the environmental movement was always so challenging because it's so broad. It's a one that encompasses everything from forests to water to the atmosphere to, you know, all kinds of issues. And that it's been politicized significantly in some countries, particularly big polluting countries like the United States, for example. Maybe say a little something about that, and maybe we can move into your work about China in particular, because it sounds like in looking at some of your work, there's some distinction between maybe what we see, how we see the environmental movement in the United States versus how it's seen in China.
You know, environmental movements emerge in different parts of the world when they can, and they can also be suppressed, often at great cost to, you know, human lives and cost to the environment itself. A lot of the environment is concerned about with ecosystems, and some people say it's insufficiently concerned with social systems, with people. To my way of thinking, we actually, in the sort of the post-World War II era, have had two really fundamental movements that have taken place. One is the environment movement, and the other is the human rights movement. And I think the key understanding when we look back at this history is to realize that these two movements are now converging in what might be called the environmental justice movement. What I was finding is when I looked at how environmental movements started, you had to look at both the environmental side and the social justice side, the human rights side and the purely ecosystem side, in order to understand where we're going. After I finished the program about Russia, I thought I should try something a little harder, like a film made in China, because I'm very curious to see whether or not there could be a Chinese environmental movement. I think like a lot of people in North America, I had a sense that the Chinese government was pro-development, and therefore, if an environmental movement was anti-development, it was going to be anti-socialist, and therefore, there would be an opposition between the government and the environmental movement. And I think we see that in a lot of countries. Currently, in the United States, there's clearly a kind of a contest going on. And so there's a kind of a distrust by the government for the environmental activists. You know, you're reducing consumption, you're reducing development, you're going to reduce our ability to bring the poor up out of, you know, by affecting the economy, and so on. So there's this kind of inherent distrust that we've grown up accustomed to. So would that be the same case in China? And the answer was no, it's not. And this was the really surprising thing. If there was that kind of opposition, I wouldn't even have been able to get into the country to make a film. And we all know that the China's pollution problem is dreadful. You know, the smog on a bad day, you can't even see the building across the street in Beijing. It's just dreadful. The citizenry is really up in arms, but that's only the top layer of the environmental problem. They've also got a tremendous amount of heavy metal pollution of their soils. They've got a problem with having displaced millions of people to build dams and having to deal with the poverty that's generated. So they've a whole complex area of problems that you might say are environmental problems. But the Chinese central government, the party itself, realizes that there's now between 50 and 100,000 demonstrations every year in China about environmental issues. It is, in fact, one of the areas where Chinese citizens can speak out, speak their mind about something that's deeply, deeply important to them. You know, if your child is being exposed to heavy metals dumped in a lake by a factory that's just doing this for a profit, who's to blame and who's to change things? And the only place you can go to is to complain to the government and hope the government will step in. And so this is creating unrest. And if the central party wants anything, it's social stability. And so they can't simply try to shut down the demonstrations in favor of a chemical factory. In Dalian, north of Beijing, while I was there, there was 70,000 people turned out to demonstrate against a factory that they were sure would pollute. And the government didn't stifle the demonstrations. They moved the factory, or they canceled the factory. Now, that might just go somewhere where people are less organized, but in that case, it was stopped. And it was just a demonstration of that's one level of concern they have is for stability. But the other thing that I think touches people more deeply in China that I found when I would talk to people is that really the problems are accumulating. Quality of life is degenerating. The Chinese have been able to bring hundreds of millions of people up out of poverty, maybe 200 million. But now that they're middle class, they're facing a shortened lifetime from pollution. So where is the satisfaction in that? And what kind of future does that speak to for a country of 1.3 billion people? So they realize that they need to have ecologically sustainable socialism or communism or just a system, whatever that country is now. It's such a mix. But in order to be able to continue, they're going to have to resolve some of these problems. And for years, there have been people inside the Chinese government who understand this.
You're listening to my conversation with documentary filmmaker Gary Marcuse. After the break, we'll talk about his film, Waking the Green Tiger. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is Gary Marcuse. He's a journalist and documentary filmmaker who explores the development of environmental movements in different countries.
Could you just very quickly tell us about your film, Waking the Green Tiger, because it's specific to the dam on the Yangtze River.
Yeah.
And kind of what, because this is obviously a huge issue for China and other countries in the region. Dams are a huge issue for various countries in various parts of the world.
Sure.
Could you tell us a little bit about that project and how that reflects perhaps this larger environmental issue and the relationship between government and citizens in China, which is fascinating because they really don't have many other outlets to have this kind of relationship or be that outspoken on issues in China.
I wound up focusing on the suggestion of many people on a conflict over a big dam in southwestern China, almost near the down near the Vietnamese and Cambodian borders, very southern China. But that's where the Yangtze River rises in the mountains before it flows out north or out through the sea. And there were plans on the Yangtze and another river in Yunnan province in China to build 24 more dams, really big dams. And one of those dams that I was focusing on was the Tiger Leaping Gorge, a beautiful, deep, 3,000-meter deep gorge, kind of the Grand Canyon of China. And they were going to stick a dam in the middle of it, 700 feet tall, that would create a lake behind it, a reservoir that would go 200 miles up and flood out another 100,000 people and take away the breadbasket of this whole region in order to generate electricity to go to the cities. And it was also a kind of a tourist destination, but wasn't well known at the time. So I told the story, really, or I was able to record the story of the gradual evolution of a resistance movement by the farmers. And the farmers were just able, at the time this dam was planned, there was a new Environmental Protection Act that gave people a right to participate in the environmental assessment. And this was just the key that opened the door, because the farmers could now say, I'm not anti-government. I am exercising my right to speak out about the environment, because it says right there in the environmental law. So I had two jobs. One of them was to try and follow how this resistance movement grew and eventually succeeded over a period of 4 years in stopping this massive dam for the first time that anything like that had happened in China. But I also needed to follow the other little smoking gun, shall we say, to figure out who wrote this law. You know, how did it come about that the Chinese government enabled people to protest, to participate? And that traced back to some very enlightened people within the government who were trying to create the possibility for ordinary people to help supervise the environment. Because they knew in the modern era that the corporations and the companies that are all private now were not going to police themselves very well. They hadn't in the past. The pollution problems were dreadful. But if they could activate citizen involvement, they'd get, he felt, better decisions overall.
So last question then, Gary. Do you see that the environmental issue is, are we seeing improvements because of this kind of activism
in China?
Because of citizen involvement? And
yeah.
How would you then compare that then to the rest of the world? Do you feel like this is an issue that's being well addressed around the world and that our environment is getting better because
of
this sort of activity?
I think all environmentalists will say, I mean, anybody concerned about having, you know, clean air and good water, there's always somebody who wants to benefit by using a public resource, whether it's in China or the United States or Canada. And if possible, they'll, you know, externalize the costs, you know, and they'll internalize the profits. So they'll pollute. Polluting is just a way of externalizing the cost of business. The Chinese are experimenting with raising the cost of water for companies that are polluters. They're trying to put an economic marker, you know, on it and use and price the resource. I mean, so this is a kind of a modern business way of trying to control pollution. China is making progress, certainly in the environmental legislation. It certainly shifted the way that it looks at its responsibilities and its duties and the value of protecting the environment. It's now become a kind of a national priority. So they're shutting down coal-fired power plants at the same time in other places in the world. We're talking about opening them up again. So I would say that's progress, certainly in China, because they can't afford to have all that smog, and the planet can't afford it either, but they have an immediate problem to deal with. So I see a wide range of areas where environmental laws have really starting to come into force in China. And I think that's really encouraging. When I go to universities and talk to young people, they say, you know, it's really nice to know that China's taking action, because if they don't do anything, why should I? Because we, you know, we're so much smaller, we're so fewer. But if they're doing something, and if the activists in China can succeed, surely we can do something in our situation as well, where we have so many more rights to participate.
That is a really interesting and amazing point. So thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate you being here with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a lot of fun. I enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Vancouver-based filmmaker Gary Marcuse. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview and produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.